Somebody come.
But I like them all.
The House Committee on Education will come to order. We are going to take our agenda in backwards order so that we can get the quick thing out of the way first, which is the introduction of committee measures. You have three at your place. One is related to use of additional Individuals with Disabilities Education Act funds. One is related to the use of Oregon Opportunity Grant Program funds for career schools, and the other is related to nationally normed assessments and choices that school districts are able to make about which companies to use. Again, the introduction of committee bills is a courtesy. By voting to introduce the bill, you are not committing your support for or against the bill. You're just allowing us to get them into the pipeline.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dimbro.
Madam Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 2846, dated 2-17-09. LC 2925, dated 2-23-09. And LC 3606, dated 2-24-09.
Representative Dimbro moves that LC 2846, LC 2925, and LC 3606 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I have an extra copy of 3606 if there's someone who doesn't have one.
Right. It's
an extra. But Representative Kahn?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm having a problem pulling it up electronically.
Okay. Good.
Of course. Any further discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the bills are introduced as committee bills. So, colleagues, before we get started on the rest of our meeting, I wanted to make a few comments both about the logistics of today and tonight and where we are in a process of discussing services to children with some extraordinary needs. The first thing is that we are in Hearing Room 50 today. I believe that there is also an overflow room, which is meeting. We're being broadcast on split screen so that whether you are in this room or in another room, you are able to see the ASL interpretation. And because we do have an ASL interpreter, I would ask each of us at the dais and those who may come to testify at the table to remember to speak slowly, which is hard for me, but to remember to speak slowly so that the information can be accurately interpreted. And also remember that when individuals are coming to the table, they are the individuals that are speaking to us, and our questions are offered to the people who are testifying rather than to the interpreters. So please, throughout the day, be sure that you are presenting your questions directly to the witnesses that are at the table. Am I missing anything else in terms of logistics? Signing up.
Madam Speaker, and I don't see our person over right now, but Zach is here. If there's anyone else that wishes to sign up to speak, we'd ask that you, when Zach gets over there, he can assist you as far as signing up. So please feel free to do that.
I anticipate there are many of you here today that will want to speak. I know that there are others that want to speak to this issue and could not be here at this particular meeting time. So we are going to go in this meeting until 3 o'clock this afternoon, and we will recess and reconvene at 5:15 this evening. So when we get to taking testimony, I'm going to find out if there are any of you that can't come back at 5:15. We'll get through as many people as we can before we reconvene at 5:15. But we will stay tonight until everyone that wants to be heard has had the opportunity to be heard. And as you will note, today we have an informational hearing specifically on the Oregon School for the Blind. We've posted a public hearing for House Bill 2113, which creates the Special Schools Trust Fund. And that bill is related directly to the issue of the consolidation of the School for the Blind on the Oregon School for the Deaf campus. As everyone in this room realizes, I think, the State Board last week voted to uphold the the recommendation to consolidate the two schools and to take the proceeds of the sale of the School for the Blind to put into this trust fund to pay for remodeling the facilities at the Oregon School for the Deaf. I know that many of you would like to have a public forum in which to talk about that issue particularly, and you are invited to do so. This forum is for that. But I also want to be clear that the bigger issue of discussion that we're having today is what the best future of services is for students who experience visual impairment in the state of Oregon, and whether or not continuing to have a separate residential school for students with visual impairments continues to be the preferred and best use of our educational resources to meet the needs of those students, or if we should look at closure, not consolidation, but closure of the School for the Blind and redistributing those resources back to support students in their local communities. I wanted to make a couple of comments about that. First, there is no discussion in this committee about the closure of the School for the Deaf. That closure discussion is centered around the question of the School for the Blind. What this committee has done on Monday, Don Wimette welcomed us, and we had a tour. We spent 2 hours out at the school where we were able to meet students and see the excellent instruction and opportunities that are offered to students there. We are having this hearing today and again at 5:15, and on Friday we have students from all across the state who experience blindness or visual impairments who are coming to us with their families and their parents and their educators to talk about the challenges and successes they are having receiving educational services in their local school districts and their local school communities. This is not a discussion that is being started for the purpose of saving money. Every student, regardless of their ability or disability, has a right under federal law to a free and appropriate public education. And we have a moral obligation to do everything that we can to support every student to make the best progress that they can make in our public schools. That is a commitment that I take very seriously. As the parent of a significantly disabled child, that is a battle that I fight every day in terms of making sure that my child has access to adequate and appropriate services. In my life leading up to this point, my work as a special education advocate, as the Children with Disabilities and Family Support Coordinator for the Department of Human Services, leaves me acutely aware of the multitude of challenges that face families in the state of Oregon that are raising children with multiple disabilities. My goal in bringing this discussion before this committee is to make sure that we are doing everything that we possibly can to provide the best possible services to every child in the state of Oregon. I know that there will be strong feelings on this issue on both sides, and I hope that what we can all hold in common is our belief in the value of these students and our commitment to having a discussion about what we can do to best support them and to honor and respect in each other that we may disagree about what that choice may be. So with that, we have two legislators that are here that wanted to offer some testimony before they go back to their committees. I'm going to call them up first, and then we will move on to our organized panels and then get to the important part, which is hearing what each of you have come here to say today. So I would invite Representative Brian Klem and Senator Doug Whitsitt, please. Oh, and Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of order and clarification. Are we going to have limited time on testimony since there are so many?
What we are going to do is we're going to ask people to be conscious that there are many people. We are recessing at 3 o'clock and coming back at 5:15. And I'd ask people to be considerate of the committee, but we will stay tonight until everyone that has something to be heard until everyone that has something to say has been heard. That's how to construct that sentence. All right. Thank you. Representative Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Gelsinger and committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today. I was assigned to the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education in 2005 session. I had occasion to study the Department of Education budget at quite some length, really hundreds of hours. And one of the things that simply jumped off the page was the budget for the Oregon School for the Blind and the Oregon School for the Deaf. The Oregon School for the Blind costs at that time ran well over $100,000 per student. And when I divide it out now, it looks like it's closer to $150,000 or more per student. Since I first began studying this issue, Oregon taxpayers have invested nearly $15 million in educating about 33 students on
average. Senator Whitsitt, could you pull the microphone closer so we can hear you?
That would be good. My wife says that I mumble a lot, and I do. In any case, since I first began studying this issue, Oregon taxpayers have paid more than $15 million to educate on average about 33 students at that school for the blind. You compute that out, it's about $450,000 per student since July 1st, 2005, per student. My interest in these indefensible expenses resulted in my appointment to the interim committee to study the School for the Deaf and the School for the Blind between the 2005 and 2007 session. The committee was made up of educators with many years of experience providing services to sensory-impaired children, professionals who are experts in care for the blind and the deaf children, administrators, representative teachers and general care employees, parents, advocates for the blind and the deaf, and legislators. This was a very well-rounded and knowledgeable committee. The committee met five times, once at the School for the Blind, once at the School for the Deaf. All of those meetings lasted from 4 to 6 hours. So, I mean, we really looked at this issue pretty closely. I had a lot of other people come in and testify, both at the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf, and at the other meetings to get information, as much information as we could on the issue. And what we learned was often very disturbing. To call the School for the Blind a school is sort of a misnomer. The facility has not provided an education program that leads to a high school diploma for a number of years now. The facility is primarily used to house a few children with very challenging multiple disabilities that also include being blind or visually impaired. The Oregon School for the Blind is a residence facility where children are generally dropped off on Sunday afternoon and then picked up again on Friday afternoon. The preponderance of the families that have these children are in the Willamette Valley and are generally within about 50 miles of the facility because the commute pretty well keeps other people from using the facility. That's not 100% accurate, but I mean it's the preponderance of the children do come from the local area. This management design precludes attendance by most children from greater distances. The facility maintains 11 buildings for about 33 students. That's one building per three students. The staffing generally exceeds two employees per student. Just the cost of the compensation for the maintenance workers at the Oregon School for the Blind and Oregon School for the Deaf in 2005 was over $10,000 per student, just to pay the maintenance workers. The facility is very old and needs significant repairs and upgrades in order to make it a safe place for the children to be housed. We are told that the buildings would be a death trap in any significant seismic event. The cost of the required basic structural renovations to make these buildings safe to occupy is truly prohibitive. The location of the facility between Willamette University and the hospital makes that land of rather unique value. Funds acquired from the sale of the facility will be used to provide a safe facility that is capable of providing much expanded services to the entire blind and visually impaired community in Oregon's children. As I recall, the Oregon School for the Deaf facility is on a 51-acre campus. There's a lot of room out there. To the extent that it is advisable and appropriate, there is more than adequate space to maintain separate facilities, if that would be the design of the Department of Education. There are about 2,000 students currently attending public schools in Oregon that are blind or visually impaired or that are deaf or hearing impaired. These students attend classes and extracurricular activities with non-sensory impaired children on a daily basis without being hazed and without being abused. The appropriate management in these public schools keeps all children safe and unchallenged by inappropriate behavior. I see no reason why the environment cannot be provided at the combined Oregon School for the Blind and Oregon School for the Deaf When managed by professional administrators and teachers selected for their expertise in providing education to sensory-impaired students. In the spring of 2006, our committee voted unanimously to close the campus at Oregon School for the Blind and move the operations to the campus of the Oregon School for the Deaf. As a matter of fact, the preponderance of the committee was in favor of closing the Oregon School for the campus, just period. I strongly believe that all the money should continue to be appropriated for use to provide educational services for the sensory-impaired students in Oregon schools. And I mean that very sincerely. I don't think this is not a cost-cutting method. This is an exercise in trying to use fiscal responsibility in utilizing that money to the best ability. The financial decision is obvious and critical. The political will to do the right thing for the Oregon sensory-impaired students has failed to materialize in past legislative sessions, and this has been, as you know, argued a lot for a number of years. I think it is long past time to take action. As currently provided, the Oregon School for the Blind represents an archaic, ineffective embarrassment to fiscal responsibility. This money should be providing benefits for all blind, visually impaired, deaf, and hearing-impaired students in Oregon, and I really hope that this legislature is able to see past the political rhetoric, and this time do the right thing for the visually impaired students of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Whitsitt. Representative Clem.
Thank you. Members of the committee, I'm going to be back actually this afternoon to talk about the merits of the bill. I've been involved with this issue actually.
Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Representative Brian Clem, House District 21, the school is on the street that is the border of my district. I've been involved with this issue since 1995 for the last 14 years, and we'll come back and talk to you about that. And I have serious concerns in opposition to some of the bills, not all of them, but some of the bills, and I will dictate out. But for the people in the audience, really, is why I'm here right now, this is a mea culpa visit. My office, which I am in charge of, put out an informational email to people about this hearing. In it, we had one major error of fact, and I would characterize I'm learning of some of this today for the first time myself, also a oversimplification of Representative Gelser's views on this, which hopefully will all come, the more complex discussion will come out as these things go along. The one major error of fact is that she does not want to close the deaf school. And I have an email from my office saying she does. So that is an error on my part, and I apologize. And everyone in the audience, I want to know that. Representative Gelser, as she indicated, but it should have been me saying it, not her, has been a champion her whole lifetime for people with disabilities. She is not part of a conspiracy with the Salem Hospital or Willamette University or anything else. So for those of you who got my email, supposedly there were only three of you, but I have no idea how much further it went. I'm here to apologize, and I will come and discuss later my feelings about this particular issue.
Thank you, Representative Clem. Very much appreciated. Representative Comp.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Gelser. And before both of these fine representatives leave, and thank you, Representative Whitsitt, for all your work that you've done on this. But as a former middle school principal, my school, too, also is declared almost it is a death trap if there was a fire that broke out in my school. And I want to put in a statement about the need for many schools, not just this school, but many schools that need capital maintenance be done in their schools. I mean, the last time I met with my fire marshal, he said 90 seconds, a fire would go from one end of my building to the other end of the building, and that there's no way all of your staff and students can get out. And I'm sure that depicts this building, these buildings also, but it's a much broader issue.
Oh, I would certainly agree. In the five counties that I represent in the seven school districts, there are probably 40 schools that are of 1935 vintage or older.
Correct.
Some of them are very nicely maintained and are still an iconic building. Some of them are not.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions for this panel? Thank you both very much. Thanks for sharing your time with us this afternoon. And as we get started to set the stage, I'd like to invite up Don Wumet and Morgan Allen.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. And we actually have two mini presentations that we'd like to make for the committee today. First, I know that you toured the committee earlier this week, but we wanted to respond to some of the questions we heard from members and just give a very, very brief overview of the Oregon School for the Blind and give you some facts and figures about student enrollments and budgets and staffing. And then I'll have Don step down and I'll speak to the issue of co-location and Superintendent Castillo's proposal to do that. So we'll try to limit both of those to about 10 minutes, if that's all right.
Great, so. Thank you. And will we be able to ask questions of Mr. Wumet or Dr. Wumet?
Mr.
Wumet, before you go away. Thank you.
Yeah, that's our intention. We'll do the overview of the school first, and then we'll try to keep the two issues separate because they really are separate issues.
Thank you.
So, the document that Don and I are going to talk from kind of looks like a PowerPoint presentation, and it's just a brief overview of the School for the Blind. We wanted to give you on page 2 talk a little bit about a brief history of the school. The Legislative Assembly actually established the school in 1873 to provide an education and establish programs to ensure independence for blind students. As you know, it's located over at 700 Church Street Southeast in Salem by Willamette University. And in 1971, responsibility for operating the School for the Blind transferred to the State Board of Education, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, and the Department of Education. So our agency and the superintendent have been in charge of the school now for about 30-plus years. And another moment of historical significance, during the 2000 legislative session, this body created a board of directors for the Oregon School for the Blind, and that was in House Bill 2263, sort of the first advisory board for the school. And I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Wumet to talk a little bit about some of the mission and programs at the schools.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Donald Wumet. I'm the director of Oregon School for the Blind. It is nice to see you all again. I enjoyed having the opportunity to provide the tour for you on Monday. I want to talk a little bit about the school in general, its mission, and why that is critical. Talk to you a little bit about the curriculum that we offer. The mission of the Oregon School for the Blind is to provide a model learning environment for students who are blind or visually impaired so they can achieve educational success and become lifelong learners. Like all other students in this state, it's not enough just to learn the content. You must learn how to learn. For our students, they're going to have significant challenges over their entire lives that they're going to need to overcome, and they're going to need to know not only how to resolve them now, but how to do that 20 and 30 years down the road. The Oregon School for the Blind is a critical part of the continuum of services for children who are visually impaired, including students who are visually impaired and have other disabilities. It is the only residential program for students who are visually impaired in this state. Other elements of our mission statement is that we provide three elements. We provide a full range of flexible program options designed to meet the needs of children who are visually impaired, including those with other disabilities. That includes at the Oregon School for the Blind a school year program, which you had opportunity to see on Monday. That includes both students who live at the school, that are residential, who are there from, in most cases, from Sunday evening until Friday, right after lunch. We also offer a day program for students who live close by. In addition to that, on campus, we're providing during the summer a summer program that serves students who do not normally attend the School for the Blind, students who are visually impaired and who during the regular school year are served in their local districts with the support of regional vision teachers. And I know you're going to hear more about that on Friday. In addition, on campus, we provide assessments for students when the school district and regional program are unable to do that. We offer short-term programs, students who will come in for 1 or 2 weeks to work on very specific skills, often in the area of travel or technology, so that they're able to then return to their schools, be more independent, and be able to access their programs, again, in the local district. We provide educational services and outreach support to all students in Oregon who are blind and visually impaired, and their families, and the staff who serve them. That includes special programs that we take into the local districts. In the past couple of years, we have provided a number of programs, sometimes on weekends, to be creative and to offer opportunities when students are available, students and their families are available. We also get into the communities to be able to help families in their homes where students have developed skills, and it's appropriate that their families either make modifications in the home so that the student can be more independent, or that we're just simply able to better convey to parents what students are able to accomplish. And finally, the Oregon School for the Blind helps to focus resources of stakeholders to maximize student achievement and to work towards the goal of all students living and working as independently as possible. This includes the coordination of a low vision clinic, which is totally funded by the Oregon Lion Sight and Hearing Foundation, and that serves about 140 students each year, providing them with a low vision assessment that helps their teachers, whether they're at the School for the Blind or in the local programs, to use their vision to the maximum extent possible. Additionally, I administer funds donated by the Oregon State Elks Association that provides additional support for tuition and materials for preschoolers who are visually impaired so that they can get some of the extra things that they need so that they can be as prepared for school as possible. I mentioned on Monday our curriculum. I'm going to review that fairly quickly. The curriculum that we provide to our students is called the Expanded Core Curriculum. It's a nationally recognized curriculum for children who are visually impaired. As I also mentioned on Monday, students who are visually impaired really have two curricula that they must master. The core academic curricula that the same as every other child in the state. And additionally, these nine areas that I will now talk about. Compensatory academics, these are skills that visually impaired children need to be able to do or to be as successful as possible with their academics. This includes the area of Braille, listening skills, study skills, and organizational skills. Orientation and mobility, which is travel skill. You had opportunity to see two or three of our students traveling during the course of your visit. Travel skills can range from crossing a classroom safely and independently, to finding the bathroom next door, to getting downtown to Starbucks, if that's where you would choose to go, or getting on public transportation and being able to get to work. Skills of daily living, all those skills that we all require every day to get up, get dressed, get to work, maintain our homes. One of the great benefits of a residential setting is the ability to teach those skills in context at the time that the skill is needed. Technology has leveled the playing field for many people who are visually impaired. It allows them to access information much like everyone else does. This is something that was not true 20 years ago, but we have very advanced equipment that we're able to use with our students to teach them how to use that and to enable them to be as independent as possible. Career and vocational education, just what it sounds like, the ability to get a job, to have the work habits and attitudes to do that job successfully, and the skills in order to be able to complete a job. Because it's not all about work, we do recreation and leisure, teaching students, in many cases exposing them to different leisure options, individual and group options, and then allowing them to decide what it is that they enjoy and to develop the skills they need so that they can be as independent in that as possible. Social skills, this is one that often gets left out. It's all of the conventions that we all follow. It's maintaining eye contact with the person that you are speaking with. What most people learn is 90% observe, what they observe. If you don't have vision, you don't have the ability to learn in that fashion. You need to be told that when your teacher speaks to you, you should be looking at them or at least pointing your head towards them. And that's something that it's very critical. It's very critical for later on in life because the number one reason that people lose jobs, is not because they can't do them, but because they can't get along on the job. About half of our students have functional vision, and we're teaching them to make the best possible use of that. And again, that varies from the ability to use various pieces of equipment to be able to enhance their vision, or sometimes just being able to recognize that the light space on a wall is a window or a door. And finally, self-advocacy. Self-advocacy helps students to be able to make their needs known. It helps them to be able to become a part of the decision-making process for their futures. These nine areas are the focus of the program at the Oregon School for the Blind. As you observed on Monday, we do work on academic skills, but that's not the focus. It's, again, these nine areas. And at this point, I will turn it back to Morgan.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
I'm on page 6 now. I know that when we were walking around, I had several questions about budget and staffing. So page 6 gives an idea of the legislatively approved budget. This is including actions through the December e-board. Obviously, in the co-chair's budget, there's potentially other reductions that would need to be made. But for the current biennium, $8.6 million to operate the school, of which about $6.75 million is general fund. And then there's some other funds, which includes federal monies. State school fund dollars, grants, and monies that the schools raise through renting out some of their space. In the 09-11 budget, the essential budget level, which was included in the governor's recommended budget for the two schools, was $8.7 million. Moving on to slide.
Morgan, just for a moment. For the two schools was $8.7 million, or for the school for the blind was $8.7 million?
Excuse me, just for the school for the blind.
Thank you.
Sorry, I'm so used to talking about them in concert that sometimes they'll slip. Moving on to slide 7, during the current biennium 2007-2009, the legislatively approved budget included 69 positions, which is 52.3 FTE. That's inclusive of shared and local education positions. Some of the positions, particularly the management positions, are shared with the Oregon School for the Deaf, and there's a breakdown of those staff members to give you an idea of that. As you know, many of these students require one-to-one services, and when you operate a residential school, you're going to need to have cafeteria staff, maintenance staff, residence hall staff, and other things like that you might not have at other schools. Moving on to page 8, we wanted to give you some historical perspective of enrollments and included enrollments dating back to the year 2000. Currently, there are 32 students at the School for the Blind, 6 day students, and 26 residential students. And that's pretty consistent since about 2005. There have been about 30 students at the school each year. And then finally, moving on to slide 9, the last thing we just wanted to make mention of, again, during the 2007 session, House Bill 2263 passed, created advisory boards of directors for the School for the Blind. The board is specifically charged with making recommendations to the Superintendent of Public Instruction on the operation of the school, and we recently received their 5-year plan. I know many of you have received a copy of that as well, and the superintendent and the department have had a chance to review that. Thought it was very well done and very thoughtful and had a lot of good information that will help inform this discussion as we move forward. The board did get 2 specific powers in statute, and that is to appeal any decision of the superintendent in regards to locating the schools within Marion County, and the board can appeal any hiring or firing decision for the directors at both the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf. So those are their two statutory powers. And then, so with that, we thought we would take a break, and we really want to keep the topic of co-location separate. So you've had a chance to tour the school and get some facts and figures, and Mr. Womed and I would be happy to answer any questions on that, and then I will give you a short presentation about co-location.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you. Looking at page 8, and looking at the recent enrollment levels, I'm just wondering if you could really quickly tell me why, for the first 5 years of this, 2000 to 2004, you averaged about 45 students a year, and then it goes down to about 30, a little over 30 now from 2005. What happened?
Chair Gelser, Representative Thatcher, in 2003, both the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf eliminated their weekend programs. We did that as a cost-cutting measure, dealing with a shortfall that we had at that period of time. That has made it, since that time, with the absence of the weekend program, it has been more difficult for students, especially from Southern Oregon, Eastern Oregon, and Central Oregon, to access the program because everyone now goes home every weekend. Prior to 2003, students who lived more than 100 miles away could go home every other weekend. There was an alternate weekend option.
Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don, I just want, first of all, to thank you for welcoming us the other day. Your kindness and commitment to the students really came through very clearly, and I really appreciated that. And the same true of all your staff there. I was really happy to see just the environment in the facility. I have a question about the, what it is that causes a student to leave their local area and go to the Oregon School for the Blind, right? I mean, there are a couple of pathways that students could take. They could stay in their local area, go through a transitional kind of program at the end of their schooling, or they could go to the School for the Blind for that transitional kind of education. What is it that, and I know that these decisions are made in concert with local educators and the parents and, as well as people from the School for the Blind. So what is it that makes that determination as to this is a student that should stay in the local area or this is a student that should go to the residential facility?
Representative Dembrough, you are correct. The IEP team, every child with special education, has an individualized education program. The IEP team makes the determination of placement. If you're asking what most frequently drives the decision that a youngster be placed at the School for the Blind, I would say that it's elements of the expanded core curriculum, the 9 areas that I described earlier, and primarily around the areas of technology, activities of daily living, and again, I want to emphasize that the residential nature of the program provides a great learning laboratory for students to be able to learn activities of daily living. Work skills, career and vocational skills, and orientation mobility, travel skills. By far, those 4 areas would appear when we do placements as a part of an IEP meeting. We're looking at what program is required for the student, or what programming components are required, and then where are those components available. And the reason that students end up getting placed at the School for the Blind is that either the components are not available in their district with regional support, or the level of intensity that the team believes that the child is going to need to be successful, to be able to successfully achieve their goal, is not available in the local district with residential support.
And just following on that question, how many different individual school districts are represented among the 32 students?
Chair Gelser, I don't know. I know we have 6 students from the Salem-Kaiser district.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to get
Chair
you
Gelser,
that information.
We can get that
we'll
information.
Get you the information.
Thank you. And I think along with that, just the communities that each of the students come from would be helpful. Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Mr. Wimette, thank you very much for the attention you gave us the other day. And Senator Whitsitt brought it up, and you guys have had it in your presentation, and though I don't want to get fixated on dollars and savings, it probably is part of the equation and decision. Where do we, and so this has to do with the students and the dollars, if we can talk about them both simultaneously, where do we line up in, for a popular term these days, best practices? Federally with other states, how do we align? Do other states have facilities similar to this that are alone and separate? Do other states have combined facilities? Can you give me a quick glimpse of where we are?
Chair Gelser and Representative Huffman, as part of the materials that we've provided the committee today, there's something called the summative report that has a lot of that kind of information. Just to give you a high-level overview, I believe there's 40-plus states that operate these types of schools, residential schools for students who are deaf or visually impaired. I believe there are 8 states that currently have those programs located in the same facility or on the same campus. I don't believe there's any sort of federal requirement that states have to have these types of facilities. And we could do some research and see if we could get you some cost comparisons. I don't have any of those numbers off the top of my head, but we could look at cost comparisons, perhaps at what some of those other states are spending on their schools and get you that information.
Yes,
thank you. Just to follow up. On the school for the deaf, actually two things. There are some blind students or visually impaired at the school for the deaf also. Can you refresh my memory how many students are out there with visual impairment at the school for the deaf?
At this point, I'm aware of 2 at the school for the deaf who are also visually impaired.
Okay. And one concern that I do have in that part of the curriculum at the school for the blind is I would think the proximity of the facility really benefits students in trying to find their way to Starbucks or to a bus stop or to train them and teach them the ability to navigate within a downtown or a city area, a cityscape. How does the current 52 acres at, because I haven't been to it, so I apologize, but the school for the deaf that is being considered to co-locate, how does it lend itself to a cityscape, or how would you deal with that?
Chair Gelser and Representative Huffman, the campus of the Oregon School for the Deaf is also located in Salem. For those of you who may drive on the Salem Parkway, there's a Home Depot that you see when you pass, when you get into the downtown corridor, and the School for the Blind is 52 acres or behind that in a residential and commercial area of Salem. It's not in the downtown core, but that's one of the things we can talk about when we talk a little bit about more about co-location. But we think that some of the things around mobility training, such as the sensory garden, there's plenty of space on the campus of the Oregon School for the Blind to replicate those and sort of bring those types of programs over. And it still is within the city of Salem. We think there's easy transportation options for busing students or transporting students to the downtown corridor because they are within the same city.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions? I have a couple that just came up on our tour, and I wanted to make sure that they came into the record. Could you, recognizing that all 32 students have a visual impairment, one of the questions I've gotten back from colleagues here in the building that weren't on the field trip, how many are blind of the 32 students at the School for the Blind?
Chair Gelser, we're talking about totally blind. Is that the question?
Yes.
Approximately half of our students have no vision. Approximately half have some functional vision. So If you needed more specifics, if you need more specifics, I can pull that information out. It would be about 16 of each.
That's helpful. And then how many of the, we talked a little bit about autism while we were there. How many of the students at the School for the Blind have autism?
I believe at this point there's six.
Okay. And then the last one was if you could talk a little bit more, just for our record here, about the issue of having a K-12 curriculum. What happens to these students in terms of the ability to pursue a regular diploma or our new modified diploma, and what they're doing when they're at the school in terms of accessing science, social studies, math, reading, K-12 public school curriculum?
Chair Gelser, the we are able to support academics for a student who would be receiving them through their local school district. We currently have a student, which I think I mentioned on Monday, who expects to return to high school in the fall of this year. We're supporting the academics that are being taught in her middle school, the middle school that she normally would be attending. We don't have the range of teachers with the academic qualifications to do the entire academic core. Again, ours is a small program. We're unable to do that. We can provide support for many students. They're first coming to the School for the Blind at age 17, 18, having completed most of their academic program in their local districts. There are circumstances where we're providing helping them to earn the last credit for their diploma. We've had students in recent years who have taken a course at Shemeketa Community College, for example, to earn their last English credit. So we're supporting the academics, again, not providing the academic core.
So to clarify, it would, and I noticed in reading the long-range plan, I think that's one of the things that surprised me and jumped out, that one of the long-range goals might be to develop an academic K-12 curriculum. Would it be accurate to say that the School for the Blind is not offering a school curriculum in the way that we traditionally think about it in terms of offering academic instruction to students that enroll there?
Chair Gelser, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I was not able to attend the tour, which I heard was very valuable. I was in Grants Pass on the Healthcare Committee roadshow, so I'm trying to catch up on everything here. Can you tell me how long the average student is at your school? And I don't mean Sunday through Friday. How many years does a person spend there?
Chair Gelser, Representative Harker, I can't give you an exact number. I know that because more of our students are coming to us at older ages now, that the number of years that they spend at the school is going down. I would estimate probably an average of 2 to 3 years at this point. However, I do know that we have at least one student who will be graduating this year, aging out this year, who's been at the school for quite a number of years, probably most of her educational career.
And Chair Gelser, Representative Parker, I've been noting some of these questions that we need to get you a little bit more detail on, and we'll endeavor to get those back as quickly as possible.
Well, and following on that question, did you get your question answered?
Follow up.
Okay. Following up to Representative Harker's question, I mean, on our tour we met some students who were significantly younger, who appeared to be 9 or maybe 10 years old. Would those students also be planning to be there just for a year or two, or would that plan be for the long term? And what's happening in terms of literacy instruction for children of that age when they're there, whether that's literacy through Braille or reading or picture systems, or there's a whole variety of ways that literacy is done in, for very high-need kids.
Chair Gelser, the decision on placement for students is re-looked at every single year when they have their IEP meeting is held. We are, for students who are ready to work on literacy, we're providing the appropriate instruction. Some of the students you saw the other day are working on cause and effect and being able to communicate some of their own basic needs. If a youngster is shows the ability to accomplish a more academic program, that would be one of the reasons that the IEP team would probably place them back into the local school district.
So following on that, to if you're a younger kid going to the school for the blind, are you saying that the school district would have to determine that they were not capable of pursuing an academic? I mean, don't we assume that all kids have the capability and should have the opportunity to pursue an academic curriculum rather than deciding, well, we're not going to do this for this child anymore?
Chair Gelser, I believe every child should have that opportunity. I think that the IEP team would be determining whether the child is ready to be able to access that information.
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just another little funding question. These students remain the students of their sending district. So the state school fund money, does that go to the district and then pass through back to the school, or do they keep it because they have some responsibility as well for the student?
Chair Gelson, Representative Robin, my understanding, if you refer back to the slide in the other funds, that's where the state school fund transfers follow these children. And the school districts are responsible to transport the students, but that money is reimbursed through the transportation funding formula through the state school fund. So they are still, my understanding, and I'll double check this for sure, is they're still residents of their school district. The state school fund follows them, gets converted to other funds, goes into the budgets of the schools, and then the school districts retain responsibility for transporting the students and paying for that.
And a follow-up?
And
a follow-up then along that line, so, and I think we heard this at the school, so the students would then be tested, because all students are tested with the state tests, depending on what grade level they are. Those tests would be not the school, the blind test. They would go back to the school district from which they came as a part of their school district, or do you have a subset of that says this is how our kids performed on those tests?
Chair Gelser, Representative Roblin, the information goes back to the local district.
Okay.
That's correct.
And following on to the question about the transportation budget, does that mean that the cost of transportation is not seen in the budget number that's here? Those would be borne out in the local. So there are additional funds that go to supporting the students at the School for the Blind beyond what we see in the state budget allocation for the School for the Blind.
Chair Gelser, that is correct. As you know, we have a very complicated state transportation funding formula that reimburses districts for approved costs, depending on the size of the district, between 70% and 90% of those costs. And my understanding is that the transport of these students is one of the allowable costs in that funding formula.
Thank you. Representative Roblin?
And I know it's not a lot because we're not talking about a lot of kids, but that 20% or 30% would still be borne by the district. Would that come out of that district allocation that was there, or would they,
That's correct. Chair Gelser and Representative Roblin, so the transportation funds, depending on the district, 70 to 90, so the district's either paying somewhere between 10 and 30% of the transportation costs for these students going back and forth each week.
Thank you. Further questions for this panel? No, thank you both very much, and thank you again for spending so much time with us on Monday and answering so many questions and just being so gracious and helpful to us and to your staff as well. The services, I was very impressed by the services that I saw there. The technology was phenomenal, and your staff clearly very caring and supportive and very focused on the needs of those kids. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I'll relay that to my staff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so Morgan, do you want to do a really compressed co-location? Because I know we have a number of people signed up to testify, so 10 minutes max.
Absolutely.
Of presentation and questions.
I was prepared to do that, and I will skip this. So you have my written testimony, so I will not bore you to death by reading it, but I'll hit some of the highlights and just reiterate some of the things we've talked about. There was a 2005 budget note requiring the department to look at the issue of co-location and or closing the schools. And in 2006, the superintendent announced that she didn't believe that closing the schools and contracting out the programs was in the best interest of the students. And you heard Senator Whitsitt talk about the state school study committee. In March of 2007, they recommended to the superintendent that she co-locate the programs. The 2007 legislature took no action on this recommendation. Instead, the department received another budget note asking us to look again at the topic of co-location in response to that 2007 budget note, we contracted with consultants at Innovation Partnership, and their report concluded that, quote, co-location would allow optimal shared use, operating savings, and the rehabilitation and use of existing buildings. I also mentioned before the creation of the boards in 2003 in House Bill 2263. So more recently, on June 5th, 2008, the Deputy Superintendent Ed Dennis at the Department of Education, we sent a letter to the board chairs at both the School for the Deaf and School for the Blind, notifying them that the superintendent intended to pursue legislation to co-locate. This triggered their right to appeal that recommendation to the State Board of Education, and this past Thursday, on a 7-0 vote, the State Board voted to reject the appeal and uphold the superintendent's decision to co-locate. So House Bill 2113 is that piece of legislation that we've submitted. The superintendent's decision to co-locate the programs has involved a very careful review of the facts, and essentially the state board and both the superintendent and everyone really who's looked at this issue has decided that the current status quo from the schools is not very viable. So the primary question you have to ask, why do we want to co-locate? And that real question is, are we giving the students of Oregon the best education possible? And the superintendent has concluded that the current two-campus system does not provide the best services, doesn't maximize resources for the schools. And we know that the staff and the supporters have done an admirable job of maintaining aging buildings and managing really tight budgets, but we need to make some progress this session. So there are six primary reasons that the superintendent would like to share with this committee as why she believes co-location needs to happen. The first is enrollments at the Oregon School for the Blind have really decreased dramatically over the past decade. Since 2000, enrollments have decreased 40%. The second reason is the buildings at both the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf are aging and have growing deferred maintenance and seismic safety needs that need to be addressed. In the information that we provided the committee today, we included a report from OTAC architectural firm that we commissioned last year that just sort of shows you the gravity of the situation at the schools. The third reason, which was mentioned earlier, that the per pupil costs at the schools are not sustainable. During the 2007-2009 biennium, we project it costs about $140,000 per student per year to educate kids at the Oregon School for the Blind. And the fourth reason, and this is really unique, and I think this is really sort of what sealed the deal for co-location, we have this unique opportunity to self-finance critical upgrades. We know the state doesn't have any money to provide maintenance and seismic upgrades to these schools. In 2006, the School for the Blind property was appraised at about $10 million, and a year later, when we had the Innovation Partnership take a look at it, they estimated the real market value between about $13.5 and $18 million. The fifth reason is, again, very low numbers of blind and visually impaired services actually utilize the services of the School for the Blind. There are about 457 students in the 2007-2008 school year that had some sort of visual impairment, so only about 7% of those kids were served by OSD in their year-round program. And then the sixth and final reason, obviously we think we can realize a lot of cost savings when you consolidate two campuses instead of maintaining two grounds and having two food services and two sets of residential staff. We can achieve some cost savings and pump that money back into the programs. So those are the six main reasons. The superintendent has also committed to the stakeholders that they will be allowed to help participate in the co-location planning process, and we want to hear their recommendations and the recommendations of the board. What we really need to have is a developer-led process of experts in construction and services to these kids in conjunction with the stakeholders sit down and look at this issue and figure out the best way to move forward with co-location. I just want to briefly touch on sort of the principles that the superintendent has laid out for co-location. There's six. The first principle is we have to involve stakeholders in the planning. The second is that we need to design flexible facilities that not only meet the present needs but anticipate future needs for the schools. The third reason is we need to design facilities and programs to emphasize instruction and help these kids get back into their local communities and be functional, productive citizens. The fourth principle is we need to share resources and maximize efficiencies. The fifth reason is we need to keep these schools available and these programs available as placement options for school districts. And the sixth is we want the schools to serve as statewide resources for the regional programs. So there are a few other things that we'd like you to consider when we discuss co-location. And really, again, I think you heard this from several people, but co-location, it's the concept of having the two schools operate on one campus. We have over 50 acres on the campus for the School for the Blind. There's plenty of room to sort of accommodate the facilities and programs on one campus. But there's a couple other things that we think this committee should consider, too, as they move forward on this topic. The first is that neither school is currently eligible to receive funds from state general obligation bonds or facility upgrades. That's unconstitutional right now. Again, I would refer you to the OTAC report. We have some serious seismic, ADA, and other needs at these schools that need to be addressed. You guys toured the buildings. It's clear there's a lot of love, and they're shiny, and I challenge you to find people who care more about their buildings or keep them cleaner. But it's very clear that I think the average age of the buildings at both campuses is well over 50 years. And many of the buildings aren't in use or we lease space out. In fact, at the School for the Blind, the largest building is leased out to the Salem-Keizer School District as a charter school, and it houses the Oregon School for the Deaf Alumni Museum. So I know today that you're going to hear from stakeholders who oppose the decision to co-locate, and you know I'm happy to talk about that and answer any questions that are raised. That I'll be here in the evening. You can feel free to call me back up if you want at that point. I just would want to remind the committee that the superintendents carefully considered these arguments, and we believe that all of them could be mitigated or eliminated with a thoughtful co-location planning process. And many of the arguments you're going to hear, they want to delay it further. We need to study it further. We need to look at it further. And we think that we can't really wait to do that. And although the schools do have boards of directors now, they're largely advisory in nature. The proverbial buck stops with the superintendent. She's still statutorily obligated to make sure those kids are receiving a quality education. And, again, I'll just touch on these, and I'll be available to talk about these later. But you're going to really hear three basic lines of argument against co-location. The first is that we're only doing it to save money, or it's just a cost-cutting move. The second is there's too many unanswered questions. How are we going to do this? You know, what's it going to look like? And the third reason you're going to hear is that different groups of students can't exist on a single campus. Specifically, you'll probably hear that you can't have deaf and blind students on one campus. And so I just want to touch on each of those briefly. You know, again, cost is a big factor, but it's not the only factor. In fact, the superintendent gave equal consideration to declining enrollment, aging facilities, significant deferred maintenance, and this real unique opportunity to self-finance these programs. You guys, I mean, this decision was made even before the current economic crisis, and it looked like a good deal then, and it looks like an even better deal now. As far as unanswered questions, again, the best practices and the programmatic needs of the students are going to be the same whether the campuses are on one piece of property or we move them to Portland or Bend. So in our minds, the physical location of the school is not as relevant as making sure that the programs and the services to the kids are there in quality. And then I really would like to just take a moment to rebut this idea that students, deaf and blind, cannot exist on one campus. I think at the Oregon School for the Deaf, every day we disprove this notion that different populations of kids can't exist. There's a Head Start program on the campus for the Oregon School for the Deaf that operates every day. There's a charter school. And every day in our regional programs and schools all across Oregon, kids with different abilities mix in classes and seem to do just fine. So I just wanted to take a moment to single out that argument. And to try to keep it short, I'll wrap up very briefly. And again, remind this committee that current Oregon law makes the superintendent of public instruction responsible for these schools. And ironically, under current statute, the superintendent has all the authority that she needs to move the schools or even sell the property right now. What won't happen is if we put the School for the Blind property up for sale right now and sold it, that money would refer back to the general fund. What we want to do is capture the proceeds from the sale of the School for the Blind, put them in a special trust fund, that's House Bill 2113, and then that money could only be used to improve the programs for the School for the Deaf and School for the Blind and pay for some of these needed upgrades and things like that. So we think there could be upwards of $20-plus million available from the sale of the property that could be put back into the schools. So to wrap up, again, we've had outside experts, the State Board of Education, and many of your legislative colleagues have already concluded and agree with Superintendent Castillo that the status quo is not an option. And we've concluded that the best way to do that is to move forward with co-location. Even if the legislature were to pass House Bill 2113 or come up with some other plan right now, we're still probably 2 to 3 years away because you need to have a planning process, involve architects, the construction, what do you do to get the schools ready. I mean, we're still a couple years away from making this happen. And I think as legislators, you've seen many examples of things where it's really obvious to everyone that something needs to be done, yet nothing happens. And these sort of things that are obstacles and could probably be easily overcome if everyone sort of, you know, put their minds together now, they become these impossible problems that are, you know, sort of grind everything to a halt. So the last thought I would leave with you is that really our schools and our students cannot afford further delay. The superintendent's going to promote co-location. We're happy to have a conversation with you about other issues and answer any questions you might have. And I'll be here for the rest of the hearing and on all afternoon, and feel free to call me back up if there's anything that I can add. And so, again, we provide you with a lot of information. I've really tried to compress that down. So, you know, please let me know if you have more questions.
Hey, Morgan, I have two questions. One is, what is the, if you look at the co-location, do you have a dollar figure for what the cost would be for building facilities specifically for the School for the Blind? So if we were to close the School for the Blind, how would that change the scenario of cost for capital construction?
Well, just to give you a sense, and I'm going to refer to the OTAC report that you folks have in here, and if you just give me a second to get to the right page. On page 7 and on page 13, there are the architects and the seismic folks and the engineers sort of took a look at what it would cost to replace buildings and make upgrades. And on page 7, you can see just to bring the School for the Blind campus up to current code, that's seismic, ADA, and things like that, it costs you about $12.7 million. If you were to sort of bulldoze the whole school and rebuild it in the same configuration, same number of buildings, square footage, it'd cost you about $34 million. If you go to page 13, the Oregon School for the Deaf, it's obviously a much larger campus, more buildings, more square footage. It would cost you about $37.5 million to bring the campus up to code, including seismic and reinforcement and ADA and other things. To sort of build brand new, a similar size facility, the architects in today's construction costs would cost you about $100 million. So you might hear that from some folks. Well, the sale of the School for the Blind is not going to completely finance all of the necessary upgrades that you need at the school for the deaf. And I'll tell you very upfront that that's absolutely true. But what this report does, it gives us a menu and allows us to look and say, where are the most critical investments? What are the buildings that are most seriously in need of seismic deficiencies? What buildings might we want to shut down and just scrap completely? And it allows us to sort of pick and choose and plan through that process.
And I think the question I was asking was slightly different. If what you're talking about having two schools, one campus, you would imagine that there would be two sets of buildings that would be there. So I would assume that it wouldn't be simply upgrading the facilities that are currently on the grounds of the School for the Deaf, that would happen, but then in addition, you would be upgrading buildings that otherwise wouldn't be needed or building buildings that otherwise wouldn't be needed if there wasn't a second school on the same site coming. Do you have a sense of what that cost differential is?
Sure, Gelser, I do not at this time.
Okay. And then I guess the second question is, if the issue became not co-location, but the issue became closure of the School for the Blind, and the School for the Blind closed and the campus was closed, I would think it would not be appropriate to take those funds to then upgrade the School for the Deaf and to instead take the proceeds of those funds to put into some sort of a capital trust for capital improvements, technology, and infrastructure that would need to be purchased to support students with sensory needs out in local districts. Do you have other ways to get at that, at the building needs for the School for the Deaf upgrades, if either because co-location was, because either there was no change or the School for the Blind didn't go there, to get to your needs?
Chair Gelser, that is a very difficult question, and I think I would at least tentatively agree with half of your premise, which is that if you close the School for the Blind, obviously the funds that are allocated in the general fund and state school fund would go back into the regional programs. I think at this point, we'd like to have a conversation with the legislature if the legislature decided to close the School for the Blind, to what to do with the proceeds from the sale of the School for the Blind. I mean, you guys should look at this report. I mean, these buildings are old and they're in some serious disrepair. And I understand Representative Comp's point that there are a lot of buildings across Oregon that are in disrepair and need a lot of help. The quirk here is that if the legislature were to pass general obligation capital construction bonds that would benefit the K-12 districts, that money can't be used for these schools. It's unconstitutional. So your other options, you're really the only option that I see for perhaps financing some upgrades to the School for the Deaf, and you know, we could talk more about this, okay. But the two obvious ones are the proceeds from the sale of the property or a straight general fund appropriation.
Okay, and to be clear, I think I was referring to the sale of the property rather than what's currently done, that's capital that's currently invested in individuals with visual sensory impairment, and that those dollars should probably continue to be entrusted to those individuals. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Morgan, if you can answer, please. School for the Blind, each biennium has increased significant on per pupil. If we've had no capital construction or no major curriculum changes or anything like that, where do those cost increases come from?
Chair Gelser and Representative Huffman, I think I'll speak very generally to this, and we could talk more about this and I can get some more information, but these are residential campuses. These are schools. They're sort of self-contained entities, and there are fixed costs that did not go away, whether you have 30 students or 50 students. You need to have cafeteria staff. You need to have medical services available. You need to heat and light all of the buildings. You need to have 24-hour staffing at the buildings. And many of these students require one-to-one staffing, teaching assistants and teachers, so the cost, part of it is the costs have gone up because there are fewer students, but part of it is these are just very expensive programs to operate and maintain.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And this is maybe a combined question for yourself and Mr. Allen. Just to kind of summarize where I think where we're at, a couple of years ago, the superintendent of instructions requested that there'd be a co-plan of relocating the school for the blind with the school for the deaf. And since then, there's been an appeal process that went to the State Board of Education and that they have unanimously upheld that decision. And I guess the question is this, so the purpose of our meeting today is to hear all the information surrounding this topic, but how to say this? I mean, statutorily and within the rights of the law, that decision has been made at this point.
Representative Comp, if I can answer, yes, statutorily that decision has been made. The superintendent of public instruction has that authority. On the issue of co-location, the authority that the legislature has is to reach in and protect those dollars when the land for the school for the blind has been sold, to hold those in trust for special schools. The question that our committee is looking at is, with this question of co-location, will the co-location go forward as recommended by the superintendent of public instruction, or as a policy body, I think it's important for us to have both the policy and fiscal decision about whether or not it's wise to invest millions and possibly tens of millions of dollars in capital funds to continue the model of service we currently have, or given that that land is going to be sold, is this the time to close the school for the blind instead of co-location? So I think the question here is co-location or closure.
Thank you.
Yes, Morgan?
Chair Gelser and Representative Comp, just one thing that I would add, and this is just from the Superintendent of Public Instruction's perspective. Her recommendation to co-locate, and she has made this commitment to stakeholders and to the boards at both the schools, is contingent on capturing those funds from the sale of the property. So although she statutorily could take the U-Haul trucks over there right now, pack it up, and move it over, she has committed not to do that unless there's proper funding available to prepare for that transition.
Thank you, Morgan. Any further questions? Oh, yes, Representative Comp.
Thank you for the clarification, which then, Mr. Allen, that is why we have HB 2113.
Chair Gelser and Representative Comp, that is correct.
Thank you for reviewing all that one more time.
Thank you. Representative Denbrough.
Morgan, so the State Board took a position to support co-location. Did they also consider closure of the school for the blind?
Chair Gelser and Representative Denbrough, I can get the committee the exact language of the motion the State Board made, but I would characterize it as a blank check motion or a blank check affirmation to the superintendent. They basically said, not only do we uphold your decision to co-locate, we think you should. We're giving you all the authority you need to do whatever else you think is right with the schools, including closing one or both of the schools. That was, in my opinion, made very clear by members of the State Board of Education.
And so, Madam Chair,
yes,
sorry. So maybe you said this, but is there a timeline for the superintendent deciding if she wants to go the closure route? Is that something that's on the docket? And
Chair Gelser and Representative Denbrough, the superintendent's consistent position has been one of co-location, and we will continue to advocate for that position throughout this session.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Any final questions? Thank you. With that, so don't panic when I bang the gavel, because I'm going to move us to the public hearing. But I'm going to close the informational session on the Oregon School for the Blind. And I'm quickly opening a work session on House Bill 2544, We're carrying House Bill 2544 over the work session over to Monday, March 2nd, closing the work session on House Bill 2544, opening a work session on House Bill 2062, holding House Bill 2062 work session over to Friday, March 6th, closing the work session on House Bill 2062, opening a work session on House Bill 2063, carrying over House Bill 2063 to a work session on Friday, March 6th, closing the work session on House Bill 2063, and opening a public hearing on House Bill 2113. And I have 9 individuals that are signed up here to speak, and it's 2:15. So as I call you up, if you have the ability to come back tonight at 5:15, will you just wave your hand at me so we can make sure that we get up first, everyone that doesn't have that opportunity to come back? I am committed to making sure that everyone has the opportunity to be heard. So the first three, you can't come back? What's your name?
George
Shearer. George. So we see three. So the three that can't come back, come on up and just tell me who you are, and we'll take care of it that way. So I heard one is George Shearer. Is that correct? Yes. Great. All right, Mr. Shearer. And we can pull, if you can pull the microphone.
We may need to.
Got it.
Oh, I see.
Thank you. And I'm sure many of you have been here before, but some of you haven't. The way that this works is when you come up, if you state your name for the record, and then go into your comments.
Okay. You want me to start?
Yes, you can start, Mr. Okay. Mr. Shearer, correct? But you still have to state your name for the record.
Shearer, right. You're right. Okay. Chair and the committee, good afternoon. My name is George Shearer, and I live in Albany, Oregon. I am not a typical deaf person. I am deaf and an alumnus of the Oregon School for Deaf, even though you might not think so. I lost my hearing at the age of 12 because I can speak so well. I am here to represent the Oregon Association for the Deaf as a legislative chairperson. I am also here as a private citizen and a taxpayer. The association is against the idea of the blind school moving to the deaf school property. Blindness is a mobility issue, and the location of the deaf school is not a safe mobility training area for deaf children. I see by the hearing today you took a tour of the blind school. Did you take a tour of the deaf school yet in the area where it is? I think if you do, you will understand why I feel that it is not a safe mobility training area. The deaf school property is an older part of Salem. There's lots of industries on the east and north side of the property with heavy truck traffic. The west and south side of the property is an older residential area. There's also train tracks that run along the northeast side of the property. The school property is not flat, but has lots of slopes in it. Sidewalks on the campus and surrounding neighborhoods are very old and in need of lots of repairs and replacements. The city of Salem has said that residents must pay for the repairs or replacement of sidewalks on their property. Many of these residents near the campus are on fixed incomes and would be a hardship on them. I know the issue of moving the blind school to deaf school's campus is all a money issue. I think you as a legislator should be doing a lot more of hard searching questions about the system of education of the deaf and blind students in Oregon and other states. Once you have all the information and understanding in the education process of these students, then you will start looking at money issues. An example is in the state of Florida. They no longer have mainstream programs for the deaf in that state because they found that to educate a deaf child in a mainstreaming program were more costly per child than in the deaf school programs. I have given you other papers. That is an article that was written in the Statesman Journal in my answers to that article. I have also given you a copy of the National Association for the Deaf stand on the education of deaf children. The educational process must be at least 16 hours per day, 7 days a week, same as a normal hearing child. Hearing people sleep 8 hours out of a day, and 16 hours they're in a learning environment, regardless of whether they're in school, at home, or anyplace else. With a deaf child, that's not true. A deaf child will sleep 8 hours, and unless he is in an environment where his native language is used, he's not learning. You're putting him into a mainstreaming program. He's there maybe 6 hours out of a day with support services, an interpreter, another thing. But once he leaves the school does not provide any services whatsoever. So he's out of a learning environment. So you need to look at all these different settings to see where is the child getting the most education at. And this is why I'm saying that you need to ask a lot of questions, technology, and see what, because you want to have the best product in order to get your money back of what you're going to spend. Another thing that bothers me about this whole issue is there's no deaf or blind in this committee. There are no deaf and blind on the OD's committees that came up with all this stuff. Why are hearing people, normal hearing people, always making the decisions without asking us what we want, what we need? Time and again over the years, you've set up committees in various state agencies, but you never include any of us on these agencies. You never ask us, what do we want? What is best for us? And this is why I feel that if this committee is going to do things like moving the two schools together and whatnot, you need to really analyze everything, not just the money, not just the location, but everything. On a different issue, I would like to see you to create a bill or attach something to an existing bill that would require special education students, IEPs, to include information on OSD and OSB. Also, this bill or attachment could require all doctors, hearing aid audiologists, anybody connected with hearing and sight to be given information about OSD and OSB. Many times school districts will not let parents know about these programs because they want to keep the child in their district so they can keep the money. A lot of times doctors, audiologists, and them, they don't tell the parents about these things. And I think if you actually sit down and talk with parents of some of these children, you'll find that they knew nothing about them. I lost my hearing when I was 12. I'd already developed all my language and everything. But the thing I lost was communications. Deafness is a communications thing. Luckily, my mother went to the right doctor, and when Mom asked, where am I going to get him go for an education? They said the deaf school. I went to that deaf school. The first night there, I was at a supper table. A long time ago, you used to have bowls, you know, you pass around like a family. Well, my milk was all gone. Down the table was a pitcher of milk. I wanted that milk. So I tapped the kid next to me, and I pointed to the pitcher, because I didn't know sign language or anything. I pointed to it and pointed to my glass. He just looked at me and kept on eating. I thought, well, how am I going to get that pitcher? So the kid next to me was assigned to help me. I asked him, I says, I want that milk. Get the pitcher for some milk. He says, milk, please. So I said, milk, please. That pitcher flew down the table. It hit me. It hit me. Communications. I just lost it. Now I found something different. A different way to communicate, you know. And that's when you're looking at blindness. Blindness, you can still hear everything. You can still hear everything around you. But deafness, you can't. You sit in a restaurant eating, but people around you are talking. You pick up little information from people around you talking. I don't. I have to depend on sign language. My learning is visual. So you're looking at two different things. If you want to move the blind school over to the deaf school, that's fine. But don't take away what we have now. In fact, if we could take all of the mainstreaming kids who are deaf and put them back in the deaf school, you'd have a problem. There's not enough room there to get them all in. But that should be the proper place for them to be. 24 hours, well, not 24, take away 8 hours for sleeping. 16 hours of education all day long. You need to look at a lot of things. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much. So, hello.
My turn?
Let's go to, I'm not sure anyone's name since you came up, so let's go with the woman in the middle first, and then we'll come, is that okay? Great.
Okay, my name is Bill Shepard. I went to school, I started out back in Indianapolis, Indiana, went to Horace Mann grade school, had my eye accident, and we moved out here because somebody said doctors were better. But I was 7 years old, and the superintendent of the blind school came out to our house. We were living in Boring, and talked to my folks and wanted to bring me down to the school and at least check it out. And so we come down, and we spent a whole day walking around, checking out the campus, and it was a lot different than it is today. There's only about four buildings that were there when I first started that are still there. And it was a regular school. We had educational program along with public school that went from kindergarten through ninth grade. And I went to school there. I enjoyed it, and I would recommend it. I don't know if I'd say all the way from kindergarten to the ninth grade, but I went up to the eighth grade, and then I quit and went to Sunset High School. And then I went over to Washington High School, which I graduated from, and several colleges. But we didn't have cane travel at the blind school back when I was going to school there. They started a program in 1962. It was a summer program, ran the month of August. And they had people from Western Michigan and the Veterans Hospital from Chicago come out, and we learned cane travel. Well, since then, they've started training students to use a cane from whenever they can get to them and start teaching them, which I think is good. And I think the blind school needs to be there to take younger students, maybe for 4 or 5 years, for them to get their braille skills down, their computer skills, their cane traveling skills. And then if they want to go back out into public school, I think it's great because they've learned how to do things for themselves. They've learned how to read and write. I know I talk to a lot of the students that are coming into the blind school on what they call field day in May. They come and do all kinds of track and stuff. And I ask a lot of them, I say, well, what do you do if the class is having a movie today or if they're going to go out and play on the playground? I hear so many of them say, oh, my teacher just tells me to go in the room and read my book or do what I want while the kids are playing. I can't go out. I might get hurt. And that just, yeah. But You know, I've been following this since I've been out of school. I was with the National Federation for the Blind. We formed in 1970 here in Oregon and been with them pretty near off and on ever since, and been at every legislation thing that's been trying to get rid of the school or put it over on the other campus. I've looked at a lot of the reports that are coming in. And one thing I can't really get, they're saying, you know, well, if you look at their numbers, it's cheaper to remodel the school than it is to rebuild out there and try to redo it. Well, the deaf school is on 52 acres. It's prime industrial land. Why not sell 32 of them and redo both schools, and they'd still have money to put back and work with? I can't see. I was in 1957 to 59. My folks moved to California in San Jose. I went to the California School for the Blind in Berkeley. And they were going to try to put the blind school and deaf school, they had separate campuses, but they were going to try to join them. So they thought, well, first of all, we will build an infirmary here and a dining room here and let the two schools use them, because they weren't that far apart. But if you've ever been in a high school cafeteria and seen food fights, you ain't seen nothing until you've been on a campus where they're blind and deaf. There is such a communication problem. Trying to talk to somebody, you know, like George was saying, he does everything visually. Blind people do it by hearing. And hey, there's a real communication problem there. I couldn't point down the table and say, hey, pass me the pitcher of milk, I want it. Somebody down there might try to steal my plate, or they might throw the pitcher down the table. I mean, there's all kinds of things that go on in schools like that. I've been in that situation. I've been in the situation in Indiana, in Indianapolis, where I went to the School for the Blind for about 6 months, to where it was so rigid that this week the boys got to go on the playgrounds 3 days a week after school, and the girls went in the basement and they had different activities down there. And then the next week it was reversed. You were never allowed on the same playground together. And you know, it's, there's a lot to learning mobility. I've been out to the deaf school. I've walked that campus. And like I say, I consider myself a pretty good mobility traveler. But there's no sidewalks out there that are decent. The bus zones are so far away from the school, they're going to have to either talk to the city or Chariot and say, hey, you know, we're moving the school. We need you to bring your bus all the way out. Are they going to do it? Well, you see what problems we're having. We can't even keep Saturday service or holiday service. So why would they want to move it out even further out of town? They're cutting their routes. But I think the most important thing, I want to see the kids, what's best for the kids. And I don't think that would be. I think it'd be better if we'd bring them here to the blind school, let doctors and school districts tell them, bring the kids here for 3-4 years, get their Braille instructions, learn how to use a computer and some of the communication equipment that's out there now, and then go back to their school and they can fit right in a little better and do things.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard.
And it's, well, like I say, I started to the school there and I still had some vision in 53 when we started there. And at that time, one of the big thing was, well, if the kids got any vision at all, you push them to use their vision, even if they got to have their book to their nose and a magnifying glass to their eye. My folks insisted, no, you teach them Braille. And I can look back now at the kids that I went to the school with, and at one time in my school career there at the School for the Blind, there was 110 students. But there's probably about 8 that I can think of right off top of my head that at the time had good travel vision. They could read with a magnifying glass if they got the book right up like this. Today they've lost that. They don't know Braille. Everything is either listened to by tape or somebody reading to them. They have no skills. They have to go back and retrain through the Oregon Commission for the Blind. So I really can't see where. I was looking at the reports to remodel this school, remodel this school, or move this school and build this one. It was cheaper to remodel than it was to move. And I think you could get a lot more out of selling 30 acres than you can 7 acres. It just, I don't know.
And Mr. Shepherd, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up because we have about 10 more people that want to talk.
Okay. Well, that's about all I got to say there. I've went to school there, and I've also worked for the school there. And I've enjoyed every minute of it. And it's more like a home to a lot of the students that went there. I mean, they make real close friends. They bond with the students they're with there. And that's all I got to say.
Thank you so much.
Hello, Chair, Representatives. Good afternoon. My name is Margie Morgan. I'm the president of the Oregon Association for the Deaf, OAD. And I want to expand a little bit about who I am. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian. I'm very proud to be an Oregonian. I love the state. And, of course, I'm a voter. And I look forward to being able to work with you as we go through this process together. I'm here because the legislation is concerned about the cost of deaf students and blind students at the Oregon School for the Blind and Deaf. And I would just like to remind all of you that the pay for the amount of pay for people on the deaf school for deaf children is equal to that of statewide mainstream schools per student. Public schools, you have to provide many interpreters for each classroom, audiologists, speech pathologists, and specialists. You have to provide all these different things for less than 5 students per school. But even though there's just few students, all of these positions must be filled. And also there's the concern of have rural small schools, the ability to have interpreters is sometimes not as easy to find, and so there's a concern with that as well. At Oregon School for the Deaf, there is not a need for interpreters. We have one audiologist and one speech specialist for over 100 students on campus, so the cost per student is much less for those specialty positions. Also, the school has a rich community involved with it. There's definitely a culture that's provided. And, you know, I really think that if you close some of those small schools that had less than 5 students, that would really provide the money and the resources needed to be able to fully support the school for the deaf and the school for the blind, which would satisfy the Oregon Department of Education is searching for. So today, the purpose of my visit is to ask you guys to please not sell Oregon School for the Deaf. I want to share a little bit about the campus itself. Did you know that in the year 2010, we are going to celebrate our 140th birthday? And on campus, if you walk around, you'll see a lot of arbor trees that are planted all over, and that is a yearly tradition that the graduate classes do, and we've been doing that for over 50 years. Just another piece of the culture of that campus. There's a history there. There's a culture there. It's a great place for deaf people and deaf students to come together, and they travel from statewide to come down to all have a place where they can grow and learn together. If the Oregon Department of Education was to sell the blind school and put all of that money into trying to up and improve and maintain the campus of Oregon School for the Deaf, I do not think it would be enough money. They would still be looking for other funds. It wouldn't satisfy everything that needed to happen. And I think that with today's economy and everything that's going on, we just don't have the money to be able to provide the extra income to be able to do the rest of the improvements and the maintenance that would need to be done even though we didn't have enough money. Really, right now, I think that you really need to be able to access members of the deaf and the blind community. I mean, the decision we're making here is really going to affect these two groups, these two cultures. And I think that it would be real prudent to have somebody come in who is from those groups. I would really suggest that you invite somebody. Have someone from the Oregon School for the Deaf. Have someone from Oregon School for the Blind, their advisory committees, their advisory boards, to come in and to meet with you, to be able to find out what needs the people from these two cultures and these two groups have, not just physically, though that is a part of it, but also culturally as well. And I would really hope that you would take advantage of that. And I thank you so much for listening to my testimony tonight. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Are there any questions for this panel? No. Thank you all very much. Is there anyone else that will not be able to return tonight at 5:15? All right, I see two. So why don't the two of you that cannot come back tonight come on up this way? Back tonight, thank you very much for your patience and your and being so gracious and allowing us to hear these folks first. And I promise that tonight I will first call everyone that has signed up and sat through this hearing here today.
This is true. It's true.
Welcome. And I'm at a loss to invite you to begin because I don't know your name.
I'm Carol McCarl.
Thank you. And Carol, please go ahead.
Carol?
Yes, please.
Good afternoon, members of the House Education Committee and staff and guests. I am Carol McCarl, the founder of Blind Skills Incorporated, a local nonprofit organization that serves blind and visually impaired individuals in Salem and throughout the world. I founded the organization in order to publish a magazine so visually impaired youth would have some blind role models whose work and life experiences would teach by example. After teaching blind children in Marion and Polk and Yamhill counties for 10 years, I knew there was a need for such a publication. This brings me to the Oregon School for the Blind and the need for its programs. Across the country from Connecticut to teach at the Oregon School for the Blind in 1964, there were 120 enrolled students. The staff served all students from age 4 through the completion of 9th grade, at which time the students would return home and attend their local high schools through graduation. This process equipped them with a realistic self-image and a firm foundation. The majority of the students went on to college or were successful in finding employment in their community. In 1975, Public Law 94-142, the All Handicapped Children Act, was passed. It required visually impaired students and other disabled students to be educated in the least restrictive environment. It was left to the judgment of local school district staff and the families of the visually impaired students to determine what the least restrictive environment meant. It was then that the local and regional districts expanded services to children who lived in their communities. During that period, the Oregon School for the Blind had four outreach staff who serve students all over the state since local programs were still being designed and funded. In 1983, the outreach staff positions were cut from the budget of the Oregon School for the Blind. This caused a disconnect of services to local districts and placed additional responsibilities on them, the local districts. In 2003, a budget cut caused the necessity for students who are enrolled at the Oregon School for the Blind to return home every weekend. Formerly, those who lived distances could stay on weekends and return home every third weekend. That one change caused the enrollment to drop drastically. For some former students, the ruling caused them to spend Friday to ride home and Sunday to return to school, providing just one day with the family. This policy continues today. There are well-meaning but perhaps uninformed individuals who think that the schools should be closed and that children should stay home and attend local schools. I am a witness who can tell you that it isn't easy being blind. One needs to learn how to live without sight and lead a productive and happy life. How a blind child can do that is by learning beside peers who have the same disability and by learning from teachers who have years of experience in teaching them in an environment where they can experience success. We are living in a time when the President of the United States and many other leaders are striving to improve education opportunities for children. Those who have the power to improve programs for visually impaired students in Oregon should be evaluating how best to use existing resources. One of the strongest resources is the Oregon School for the Blind, which is serving 32 current enrollees and which continues to serve children from all over the state with its summer school programs and individual short-term enrollments. OSB is prepared for future changes as it has proven successful in meeting them in the past. The Oregon School for the Blind is the equivalent of a private school where staff have studied and dedicated their careers to the teaching of the skills blind children need in life. Those of you who choose to pay tuition to send your children to schools, such as Blanchett or Catlin Gable, may identify with parents who want to send their children to a special school for blind children. That school is the Oregon School for the Blind. In Oregon, that school is ideally located in the least restrictive environment at 700 Church Street Southeast in Salem. The best part for a student who attends the Oregon School for the Blind is that he is not the only blind student in the school. He doesn't have to continually try to measure up to what sighted classmates can do. He will be among his peers where he will develop a self-concept based on his own achievements as well as getting to know what other blind students accomplish around him. I ask this committee and the staff at the Department of Education to study well the needs of all other visually impaired children in Oregon. You have the opportunity to increase the educational offerings available for visually impaired children and their families. As a blind member of this community, I can tell you that the current location of the School for the Blind has proven to be the best suited for the development of visually impaired students as they master the skills needed to pursue success in their independence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McCall. Mr. Cleaver?
Where do we leave these copies?
Someone will come and grab them from you right now and pass them out to the committee. Thank you. Debbie's on her way. Mr. Cleaver?
Here.
Cleaver, great. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Cleaver.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Gessler? Gelser?
Gelser rhymes with Alka-Seltzer.
And members of the committee, I'm real happy that you're having this hearing today, and I'm pleased to be here, and I've got my watch here, so I understand you need to leave at 3 o'clock, and so I'll certainly honor that. I'll tell you just a little bit about myself. I got my Master's of Education at Oregon State, administrative certification from Portland State, and my certificate to teach the visually impaired from Portland State. And I taught 9 years in public school, and then was hired as principal in 1966 at the School for the Blind. Became director in 1986 and retired in 1995, so I've been retired for a while. Since retirement, though, I've substituted in both the teaching and supervision areas, administrative areas, and my certificates are still currently valid. I was appointed to a second term as a commissioner for the Oregon Commission for the Blind, works with adults, and so this will be about my 3 years as commissioner there, and it's kind of confusing because there's the commissioners and then there's the agency, the Commission for the Blind. So you say I'm a commissioner at the commission, and you know, it's difficult to understand. But the commission acts as much as the board of directors acts for them. And then I was appointed by Governor Kulongoski to the Oregon School for the Blind board of directors. Was elected chairperson of the board on last February 14th. And resigned from the board in September of 2008 for health reasons. Actually, I had a stroke. And I would like to limit my testimony then to one issue, and that is the School for the Blind Board of Directors. Now, I know many people worked on that, including myself, for a couple of years, and some legislators were included, and a number of them, and like Representative Brian Clem and Senator Vicky Walker. And there was a lot of celebrating when the legislature passed this bill. And it's been taken very seriously. There's a lot of diversity in the board. It was a board of 7 members, and 5 of the members of the 7 are blind, including the chairperson. And I want to indicate that this is the first time in 135 years of School for the Blind that blind people have had a say in the operation of the school. And I think that's a tremendous accomplishment. The board is working, creating the master plan for the School for the Blind as directed in House Bill 2263, Section 52. And the OSB board knows that there needs to be changes. We understand the monetary problems and other problems that exist. And so the board now is continuing to work on that. They're also working on gathering information and trying to find out what is happening in public schools, what's happening to the blind children. Because a little background, I guess, is when I came, which was 2 years after Carol came, 1966, it was an academic program with 126 kids, so you could tell it was growing. And it was an academic program. It was certified, and I know that our Braille students at the 9th grade were reading 2 years above grade level, and we gave the Stanford Achievement Test every year to all grades. That was appropriate. And also going back, many of these I've kept track of them, and majority of them went on to college. And then Carol indicated why the population declined, and there was also this thought that every child, regardless of how handicapped he was, should be in his own school, in his own sixth grade classroom, regardless of the handicap, and if he, the person, because what was lying on a bed, they would be there, and that was in the early 70s. This, you know, they tried to close the school for the blind a number of times. You know, I think it's five times I've been sitting before this group, and it also was the time that they were closing the mental institute, and they were closing, they closed Fairview, and they were closing, there was a theory that no one should be out of their hometown and their home school and their home sixth grade room. And so that was also the theory at that time of the State Department of Education. And so it was like, my mother was always spanking me if I'd send out any information on the school, you know. No. And so I think that had a great bearing on it. And so, anyhow, that's some of the background. Now, I'll go to my closing statement and leave these other pages. And that is, my request is that no major changes be made to the School for the Blind, such as sale of the property or the move to the School for the Deaf, until the board has completed their legislative mandate. And the legislative mandate is, in, of course, in House Bill 2263, and that is to come up with a program for the School for the Blind. And I think it's not a problem for the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf. You know, it's an Oregon problem. And the you know, the school has been there 135 years, and that's not a reason to keep it open. But I'm not sure we know what's happening to these blind children in the public schools. I mean, I haven't seen anything that would say that things are going well, and it's got to be different in each district. And I suspect when you get into some of the sparse areas of the state that the person who is responsible from the regional program, you know, I've heard where they go in and talk to the principal. I mean, and that's the contact they have with the school.
I'm going to have to ask you to sum up. I'm sorry.
I've done my thing, and I appreciate that you have allowed us to give testimony before this group.
Thank you so much. We don't have time for questions. I do want to invite you to come back on Friday. We do have children with visual impairments from all across the state coming to talk about what's happening in their local school district. So it'll be an opportunity to hear some of what's happening to blind children across the state. At 1 o'clock, 1 o'clock on Friday, 1 p.m. One until three p.m. And then just in closing, I really appreciate that historical perspective. It was really helpful, and I think the two landmark ideas that you mentioned, both the passage of the special education law, which guaranteed that every child has a right to a free and appropriate public education, and the closure of Fairview, which basically in the state made the policy that we're not going to imprison someone because of their disability, were both profoundly important civil rights accomplishments for the nation. I know, and I just wanted to clarify that point.
Thank you. One question.
Of course, yes.
Okay. I would ask that this committee in some way initiate the evaluation of the student progress of children who are in the mainstream, blind children. They don't ever get evaluated, but the School for the Blind has been evaluated, as Neil has pointed out, many times. Who's going to evaluate achievement of those?
All right.
The pile.
All right.
We might want to know how well they're doing there.
Thank you. That is an excellent point. And on that question, Don, can you get back to us, too, the number of students at the School for the Blind that are currently reading at grade level? That would be very helpful. Great. Thank you. And we will recess until 5:15. But maybe? Pardon? Okay. We will recess until 9:15 this evening. Thank you. About what? About bullying?
Hi.
You're okay.
All right, and I've got a lot of people pulling me out of your committee this afternoon,
I understand
too.
That too.
You're pulling too. What are we? Yes. Really quick, and then I've gotta get up. I'm fine right here. Okay. Well, we've introduced the bill, and I understand all the stakeholders are working on some amendments to the bill.